This is an audio archive edition of WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot, made available online by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, cvillepodcast.com.
Ken Bernstein blogs at thedailycoast.com as Teacher Ken, public school teacher. He joins me live on the program. Sir, how are you doing?
I'm doing fine, Coy. Yourself?
I'm very good. Thank you for joining us. I know you're very busy. I haven't had a chance to talk to you since the elections. What are your general thoughts about what took place?
It's not actually all that surprising that although there's communications problems in terms of what may be happening from the government, the American people voted for change. They did not get some of the change they thought they were going to get, so they decided to take it out on the people in power for whom they blamed it. What is a little bit ironic is they took it out on Democrats in the House who passed a large number of the bills that would have addressed those needs, but which never in many cases even came up for a vote in the Senate because the Republicans regularly threatened filibusters. I don't even remember how many, but it's well over 100, it may be over 200 bills passed by the House that were never brought up in the Senate because once Scott Brown was elected, the Democrats were down to 59 votes even if they held their coalition, and they had trouble peeling away Republican votes to be able to bring things up for a vote. So, you know, when people are mad, they take it out on whoever they perceive as responsible, even if that perception is not completely correct.
Yeah. And now we have, it looks like the Obama administration is going to pull a Clinton and do what Clinton did after the elections, the midterm elections in 94. We learned today that there looks like they will give in to the Republican request to continue its tax cuts for the very, very wealthy in America.
Cautious on that. That's a story at Huffington Post and CNN, which David Axelrod, who is the source of the story, saying that they may have to temporarily extend the tax credits for the top 2% in order to get tax relief for the other 98% of Americans. But there's been some walk back from the White House since that story broke earlier today, so I'm not sure quite what it is, whether it was a trial balloon or what. I will tell you that from what I know of progressive members of the House of Representatives, and I know a fair number of them personally, if they see that happening from the administration's agenda may very well be dead from the Democrats in the House of Representatives because they're pissed off right now.
Yeah. Speaking of the Democrats in the House of Representatives, what's your take on the leadership battles currently going on?
Well, what it comes down to is this. There are people who think there should be a wholesale change of all of the leaders at the top. You have the Blue Dogs who were defeated who want to blame Nancy Pelosi for their defeat when, in fact, this is my perception. If you give a choice between somebody who's a Republican light and a Republican, why go for the light? So you had a circumstance of a number of people in marginal districts where, in fact, Pelosi gave them room to vote their districts rather than voting her agenda on a few cases. A couple of the Blue Dogs who were defeated were given free walks on health care by Pelosi. But I don't know that you can necessarily blame that on her. That said, a lot of people don't like the idea of her continuing to be the face of the Democratic Party. If you'd walked by the Republican National Headquarters last week, what they'd originally had hanging out of every window was "Fire Pelosi, Fire Pelosi." And she becomes a somewhat easy target. Is some of it sexist? Yes. Is some of it because she's from San Francisco and they'll talk about San Francisco values? Yes. Does it hurt when one of the more liberal members of the House of Representatives before the election starts saying that he's not going to support her for leadership again? Peter, I'm blanking out on his name, from Oregon. I'll remember it eventually. Yes, that probably hurts as well. On the other hand, once she announced that she was going to run for leader, you notice that Steny Hoyer did not challenge her and dropped down to run for whip, which may force Clyburn to drop down as well. The reason why I say that is with the loss of two-thirds of the Blue Dog coalition in a head-up battle against Pelosi one-on-one, he loses, and he knows it.
We're talking with Ken Bernstein. You can read his work online at Daily Coast. You were talking about Peter DeFazio, right?
Yeah, DeFazio. I'm sorry, I had a blank. I could envision,
that's all right. That's all right.
Face, but I just couldn't remember at that point.
Ken, one of your recent editorials and essays that you posted online asked the question, are we now a banana republic? What is a banana republic, and what was your conclusion?
Okay, first, the title actually comes from a piece by Nicholas Kristof, who was looking at levels of economic inequality in the United States and comparing them to banana republics to our south, where you will have a few people who are very, very rich, who control the strings of power, etc., and a lot of other people. And he referred to three countries as being banana republics, one of which has taken offense, that being Venezuela, whose ambassador wrote a letter to the New York Times. I think it got published today. I'm on their press list for some reason. I don't know why, so I get all their press releases and invitations to meet with the ambassador constantly, which I never do because I'm too busy teaching. But what they were saying is, we're not a banana republic. We're not dependent on an agricultural product that is manipulated from the United States. We control our own oil, etc. Now, my conclusion is, we're not there yet, but we're getting dangerously close on a couple of grounds, one of which is the increasing economic disparity in this country, which is now at levels that we probably have not seen since the Gilded Age. The second is the implications of what is happening politically with that economic power, which you saw in a large scale with the unleashing of corporate money that could not necessarily be traced as a result of the Citizens United decision. Now, you may argue the Citizens United decision was an appropriate free speech decision, and the ACLU came in on the side of Citizens United. On the other hand, it overturned roughly 75 years of jurisprudence going back to the Corrupt Practice Act of the 1925s, which limited corporations' roles in federal elections. So it does create a situation where those that have money have even more ability to dominate what information voters get. And if you get to hear the same thing over and over and over again with no response, there is a tendency to believe it. Now, I'm not making an equivalence. Joseph Goebbels, who was Minister of Propaganda under Hitler, made the point that if you repeated something often enough, the big lie often enough, people would come to believe it as the truth. If you think that what corporations are foisting as a political statement is not accurate, and I think to a large degree a lot of the attack ads run against Democrats were not accurate. For example, in North Dakota, they were attacking Earl Pomeroy, who's a fairly conservative Democrat and a very nice guy, on the grounds of the damage he had done to North Dakota's economy. Well, excuse me, North Dakota has 4% unemployment. So, again, I see some dangerous signs. These are part of the signs. Are we at a banana republic yet? No, of course not. Are we running in a way that I think is dangerous to the health of the democracy of this country? I think so, but then again, that's my particular political orientation.
We're talking with Ken Bernstein. You can read his work online at thedailycoast.com, bluevirginia.us. You also write in the piece that we're something worse than a banana republic because we have a military force that no banana republic ever had.
We have a military force, and to a degree, we still have an economic power that no banana republic ever had. If you look at a place like Honduras or Guatemala, or you know some of the countries that we would manipulate for years, and I think we can see to some degree this goes back to the 1930s. With Smedley Butler's famous "war is a racket" statement, this being a man who won 2 Medals of Honor, who was actually approached by people around Cornelius Vanderbilt to lead a coup against Franklin Roosevelt and was testified to in Congress. None of them have ever had the ability to meaningfully project force beyond their own borders. We currently have U.S. troops, and I don't mean just Marine Guards and embassies, stationed in something over 170 countries. We regularly interfere in the internal affairs of other countries, claiming that it is in our national interest to do so. We do so economically, we do so militarily, we do so politically. Thus, if we ever lose the democratic oversight of whatever it is we're doing, and some people perceive that that's happening already, I don't know that we're there yet.
Let's continue our conversation with Ken Bernstein. You can read his work at dailycoast.com, where he blogs as Teacher Ken, and we begin with this. In 1975, there were fewer than 400,000 people locked up in the United States. By the year 2000, that had grown to 2 million, and by this year, it's nearly 2.5 million people. This has effectively created a vibrant shadow economy. American spending on the criminal justice system went from $33 billion in 1980 to $216 billion this past year, an increase of 660%. Criminal justice is now the third largest employer in America. In the 1990s, as federal correction budgets increased by $19 billion, money for housing was cut by $17 billion, effectively making the construction of prisons the nation's main housing program for the poor. Ken, you explored some of these ideas in your recent essay, The Real Costs of Our Prison Boom, and you made some connections to the public education system. Tell us what you were thinking.
Okay, first, the words that you've just read are not mine. They are from the article that inspired the piece. It was an opinion piece in Monday's Boston Globe by James Carroll, who is a very significant writer on a number of topics. He's a former Roman Catholic priest, and his father, I believe, was the founding director of the Defense Intelligence Agency, so he brings a lot of stuff to the table. I found parallels with the privatization of criminal justice and what we're seeing happening with what is effectively privatization of parts of public education. Now, I want to be very cautious here. Technically, a charter school is still a public school, although it operates under very, very different rules. However, increasingly, charter schools are being funded by hedge funds, and there are some profit-making opportunities for hedge funds in getting involved with charter schools. It's going to take too long to explain it. Just trust me on this for now. More importantly, where this tends to be happening is in the same communities that are being devastated by our criminal justice system, which tend to be communities of minorities and of poor people. Thus, it will be blacks in inner cities in the Northeast and South. It will be Hispanics, in some cases Native Americans, in the Southwest. And in some of the rural areas, including in Virginia, the rate of people from Appalachia who wind up getting incarcerated and the impact that we have on their schools, although be it not charter schools, because it's not profitable for them to be there. And what it is we're taking a lot of what you might consider the public good or the public responsibility and turning it into a for-profit enterprise. And from my standpoint, I think there is something inherently immoral. Forget schools for a moment. I think there's something inherently immoral from having people making profits off the criminal justice system, because that tends to put a thumb on the scale of justice, because people's profits depend on having more people incarcerated. And the clearest recent example of that is the source of the famous Arizona bill SB 1070, which is the one that is been interpreted by some people as you can be stopped if you're Hispanic because we presume you're illegal, were the operators of private prisons in the state of Arizona. And several of the people very close to Governor Jan Brewer in terms of signing that bill overlap with the companies that are running those private prisons, who hope to get more people sent to their prisons, which we pay for with our tax dollars.
We're talking with Ken Bernstein. He is live on the program. You think Jim Webb is making any headway with this subject in Washington?
Well, let's back up. Webb made a serious study long before he decided to run for the Senate of criminal justice. He went and looked at the Japanese system, and it's part of his overall approach. And for those who don't know, what motivated Jim Webb to run was not the war in Iraq, which he opposed, but what he saw as the loss of economic equity. He views himself as a Jacksonian Democrat caring for the ordinary people and for what happens to them. He has made this an issue. He's written about it in Parade magazine. He has brought it up on numerous occasions. Is he making some headway? He is getting some attention that people are paying some attention to. Will it make a difference in terms of national policy? That's yet to be seen. The current administration has really not taken on that much of criminal justice reform. Now, they've taken on some. What used to be a 100-to-1 disparity in sentencing between crack cocaine, which would be poor people in the ghetto, and powdered cocaine, which is the upper middle class and wealthy people, and often a difference of color, has now been lowered, I think, to like around 15-to-1, but there's still a discrepancy. So it's something that I think...
It's the same drug. I mean, just to underscore that point, it's the exact same drug. It's just prepared differently. And if you prepare it in such a way that poor people of color do, you could spend more time in jail.
That is correct. If you have possession of the equivalent pharmacological amount of crack cocaine, you are subject to a much higher sentence than powdered cocaine. And the difference is that you can buy crack cocaine in smaller amounts. It's cheaper. But to buy into powdered cocaine, you have to have a lot of money to start with. So there's something that's inherently wrong with that. I think that Webb has raised the issue to a number of people. Among my friends on the Hill, there are some, and I am much more friendly with people on the House side than I am on the Senate side because I spend more time over there. But there are a number of people who've complimented Webb on what he's done, but they don't know that they can move any, you know, clearly in a lame duck, that's not going to come up. And I don't expect it to be an issue of great importance to the new majority in the House of Representatives. And the only way something would happen on that is if the administration would make that a priority, and it has not been a priority for this administration.
Ken, what do you think we're going to see in this lame duck Congress, and what would be your advice for the Obama White House moving forward?
I'll hold off on advice for the Obama White House because I'm on record as being fairly critical on a number of things. What I think is going to happen in the lame duck Congress is going to be something very unusual that will be agreed to by Republicans before they have to bow to their Tea Party constituency and get rid of earmarks. You have none of the 12 required appropriations bill to fund the federal government have yet been passed. The government is operating on what are called continuing resolutions, which means you spend money at the same level it was authorized the previous year, which is a problem because it doesn't account for inflation or anything else. Some people thought that there might be a series of continuing resolutions. Some people advocated the Democrats do a continuing resolution that dies on January 3rd and dump the whole problem of funding the government into the Republicans' hands in the House and see if they shut things down. What I was hearing, and I was on the Hill talking to people yesterday, is that you may see what's called an omnibus, that they'll take all 12 appropriations bills, starts as 13 on the Senate side, 12 in the House, lump them into one giant appropriations bill, wherein they can still include a whole batch of earmarks, because even Republicans like Mitch McConnell like earmarks.
And Rand Paul, who ran against earmarks, is now saying he's not opposed to them as long as they don't happen at past a certain hour in the evening, as long as everybody knows that he's doing it.
Yeah, well, let's be very serious about it. Earmarks cost, in most cases, no additional money. What it is money that's going to be spent being designated for particular purposes. And the whole reason why people like to be on the appropriations committees in the House or Senate is the ability to bring money back to the district. Let me give you the best example. Robert Byrd resigned as Senate Majority Leader when he had the seniority to become chairman of the Senate Appropriations Committee. Thereafter, you got a VA hospital, you got an IRS tax center, you got at the university, you got a demonstration monorail system. I think I'm making the point of what you can do bringing federal dollars to your district. That's called bringing home the bacon, unless it's somebody else's district, in which case it's pork barrel politics.
Ken, what are your thoughts that Congressman Joe Barton of Texas is the leading contender to chair the House Energy and Commerce Committee, the same guy who apologized to BP when BP had their spill in the Gulf?
I think he's less of a problem than some of the other people. I will not get into naming names, but we have videotape of somebody who might be on an environmental committee whose response to the issue of whether or not there was global warming was to quote God's promise to Noah that never again he would destroy his handiwork. That somehow promise doesn't cover whether or not he allows us to destroy his handiwork by what we're doing. I think there are some real issues in some of the senior members of the Republican in terms of their committees, but then again, we've had some issues, and I'm a liberal Democrat with some of the Democrats who have been in senior positions on some of their committees. For example, Max Baucus, chairing Finance Committee, did a huge deal of damage to health care because the person who was advising him was basically a health care lobbyist. So, you know, I don't want this to be seen as, and this is one of the problems, that this is solely the problem of one party. Partially because of the way our campaign finance is done, both parties are addicted to the money that come from corporate or, in some cases on the Democratic side, union interest, and that therefore there is a tendency to carry what those people want in return for the campaign contributions, even if that's not the best interest of the American people.
Remember, I
teach government, so this is a personal, professional interest to me.
Yeah, absolutely. Before we let you go, your thoughts about the future of the Democratic Party here in Virginia? They're looking for a new leader, aren't they?
They are. There are two contenders. The first contender to throw is the first. There were a list of three names that were circulated, none of whom apparently wanted it. Two, I forget the third, but two of whom were Mike Signer, who failed in his attempt to get the lieutenant governor nomination, and Greg Werkheiser, who ran twice against David Albo for the House of Delegates and lost, and whom you personally know because of your connection with Sorensen, where he helped build some of the programs for Sorensen Institute. They're not interested. The first to put a hat in the ring was former delegate Brian Moran, who was apparently asked to do it by Mark Warner, who ran the idea past Tim Kaine. It's not that Tim asked him to do it. There is resistance to Brian on a number of grounds, some of which, including on Blue Virginia, in my opinion, has been over the top. But be that as it may, the other candidate is a man who's actually run a party. It's Peter, and I'm blanking out Russell out, who ran the Arlington County Democratic Party for 4 years and built it into something of an awesome machine, and who has a particular vision for what he'd like to see done for the party. I personally think that Peter would be a far more effective candidate given his skill set. Brian has some skills, but running a party organization or building it, I'm not necessarily sure is his strength. How that will play out will depend on what the party central committee wants to do, and the fact that Mark Warner is backing Moran gives him more than a fighting chance because he is the 800-pound gorilla in Virginia politics. That said, I think that there are a fair number of people who are looking at this and think that Peter has the right idea. One thing Peter wants to do is a Virginia version of the Howard Dean 50-state strategy. He calls it the 134-city-county strategy to work on building organizations, even in places where Democrats may never get anybody elected, because if you start in, you know, each of these precincts, you turn out 10 more Democratic votes, it makes a difference in a statewide race. And I will remind you how narrowly Creed Deeds lost the attorney generalship 5 years ago and how different Virginia politics, both at a primary level and a general election, might have been had he been attorney general.
Ken Bernstein, you can read his work online at dailycoast.com and bluevirginia.us. Ken, thanks for being here. I appreciate it.
My pleasure, Coy.
You've been listening to Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Charlottesville Right Now is broadcast live Monday through Friday on News Radio 1070 WINA from 4 to 6 p.m. Best-selling author and historian Coy Barefoot is the host and producer. To interact with Coy and his guests, you can call 434-977-1070. Coy can be reached at barefoot@wina.com. This audio download has been made possible by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Visit SevillePodcast.com for more.